Hakunda gir govardhan ki jai. Shri Vajrabhuma Nabhanam ki jai. Shri Nabhadut Mayapuridam ki jai. Shri Lachal Jagannath Puridam ki jai. Gangamayi ki jai, Jamunamayi ki jai. Bhakti Devi ki jai. Shrimati Tulsi Maharani ki jai. Your most beautiful lordship, Shri Shukmini Dwarkadish ki jai. Shri Shukmini Dwarkanath ki jai. Shri Shri Jagannath Baladev Subhadra ki jai. Shri Shri Gornatai ki jai. Samaveta Bhaktivinoda ki jai. Going back to home, back to Godhead ki jai. ISKCON Los Angeles Yatra ki jai. Brihad Madanga Transcendental Book Distribution Kijai, International Food for Life Transcendental Prasadam Distribution Kijai, Sri Hari Nam Sankirtan Kijai, Nitai Gaur Premanandi, Hari Hari Bo. All glories to the Seven Devotees. All glories to the Seven Devotees. All glories to the Seven Devotees. All glories to Sri Sri Guru and Gauranga, glory to Srila Prabhupada. Narayanam namaskritya Naram chaiva narottamam Devim sarasatim vyasam Tato jayam adhiryat. Before reciting the Srimad Bhagavatam, which is our very means of conquest, let us offer respectful obeisances unto the personality of God and Lord Narayan, unto Narayan Rishi, the supermost human being, unto Mother Saraswati, the goddess of learning, unto Srila Vyasadeva, the author, and Srila Prabhupada, who is the translator, commentator, and our spiritual master. Nashta prayeshu padreshu nityam bhagavata sevaya bhagavati uttama shloke bhaktir bhavati naisiki. By regularly attending the Srimad Bhagavatam class and by rendering service unto the pure devotee, all that is troublesome to the heart is almost completely destroyed, and loving devotional service unto the personality of Godhead, who is worshipped with transcendental songs, becomes established as an irrevocable fact. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So we're continuing our reading from the ninth canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam. This is chapter 18, which is entitled King Yayati Regains His Youth. Text 50 is on the board. We will recite that together. There's a very short purport, so I'll go on to 51, which is actually the last verse of the chapter. So we'll just finish up the chapter today. Tam eva hridi vinyasya vasudevam guhashayam narayanam aniyangsam Nirashir Ayajat Prabhum Tameva Hridivinyasya Vasudevam Guhashayam Narayanam Aniyangsam Nirashir Ayajat Prabhum Tameva Hridivinyasya Vasudevam Guhashayam Narayanam Aniyangsam Nirashir Ayajat Prabhum Tameva Hridi Vinyasya Vasudevam Guhashayam Narayanam Aniyangsam Nirashir Ayajat Prabhum. Please Tameva Hridi Vinyasya Vasudevam Guhashayam Narayanam aniyangsam Nirashir ayajat prabhum Tamevam hridi vinyasya Vasudevam guhashayam Narayanam aniyangsam Mirashir ayajat paramam Vaishnavins Tam eva hridi vinyasya Vasudevam guhashayam Narayanam aniyangsam Nirashir ayajat prabham Tameva hridi vinyasya Vasudevam guhashayam Narayanam aniyangsam Nirashir ayajat prabham Tameva hridi vinyasya Vasudevam guhashayam Narayanam aniyangsam Nirashir ayajat prabham Tameva hridi vinyasya Vasudevam guhashayam Narayanam aniyangsam Nirashir ayajat prabham. Okay, so synonyms. Tam eva. Him only. Hridi. Within the heart. Vinyasya. Placing. Vasudevam. Lord Vasudeva. Guha ashayam. Who exists in everyone's heart. Narayanam, who is Narayana, or an expansion of Narayana. Aniyangsam, invisible to material eyes, although existing everywhere. Nirashihi, Ayati without any material desires. Ayajat, worshipped. Prabhum, the Supreme Lord. Srila Prabhupada's translation for this verse. Without material desires, Maharaj Yayati worshipped the Supreme Lord who is situated in everyone's heart as Narayana and is invisible to material eyes, although existing everywhere. Please repeat. Without material desires, Maharaj Yayati worshipped the Supreme Lord who is situated in everyone's heart as Narayana and is invisible to material eyes, although existing everywhere. So, Srila Prabhupada's report. King Yayati, although externally seeming very fond of material enjoyment, was internally thinking of becoming an eternal servant of the Lord. Pretty clear, so we're going to move on to the next verse, which is the last verse of the chapter. Evam varsha sahasrani manakshashtar manakshukam vidadhano pina tripyat sarvabhoma kadindriyai. Translation. Although Maharaj Yayati was the king of the entire world and he engaged his mind and five senses in enjoying material possessions for 1,000 years, he was unable to be satisfied. Purport. The kut indriya, or unpurified senses, can be purified if one engages the senses and the mind in Krishna consciousness. Sarvopadi vinirmuktam tat paratvena nirmalam. One must be freed from all designations. When one identifies himself with the material world, his senses are impure. But when one achieves spiritual realization and identifies himself as a servant of the Lord, his senses are purified immediately. Engagement of the purified senses in the service of the Lord is called bhakti. Rishikena Rishikesha Sevanang Bhaktir Uchite. One may enjoy the senses for many thousands of years, but unless one purifies the senses, one cannot be happy. Thus end the Bhaktivedanta purports of the 9th canto, 18th chapter of the Srimad Bhagavatam entitled, King Yayati Regains His Youth. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prashtaya Bhutale Srimati Bhaktivedanta Swamini Tinamine Namaste Saraswate Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Srinivadi Pachyate Deshtarine Om Agyana Tavirandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshar Unmilitam Jena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitanya Manobhishtang Shtapitang Jena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Svapadantikam Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Yuta Padakamalam Sri Gurun Vaishyavangsha Sri Rupam Sagajatam Sahagana Raghunathan Vitam Tangsajivam Sadvaitam Savadutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Sri Vishakan Vitangsha Hey Krishna Karuna Sindhu Dina Bando Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namosute Tapta Kanchana Gorangi Radhe Vrindabhaneshwari Rishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Priya Vancha Kopaturubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhya Evacha Patitanang Pavanebhyo Vaishnavibhyo Namo Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shri Vasudevi Gaura Bhaktavrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. So as we've experienced up to this point in the Bhagavatam, we're now in the 9th canto, 18th chapter. A lot of far out things happen in this world, in this universe, that stretch our capacity to accept. Why is that? Because we are materially conditioned. Our normal, natural understanding of things as they are has become covered by the conditioning of the three modes of material nature. We have experience on a day-to-day basis that someone may appear physically okay, everything is there, two arms, two legs, a head, and they look good, but because the mind is not in order, they cannot perceive things properly, and therefore they react improperly, and you can't trust them for a moment. They may go off, pick up a knife and come after you, they may destroy the house, burn the house. You know, somebody who's not together mentally, intellectually, can do any crazy thing, and they can't see things clearly. You point out something to them. This is this, that is that. Don't do this, don't do that. The reaction will come like that. They can't accept it. They can't understand it because their vision is covered by the fact that their mental capacity has been impaired. So in general, our vision of this world is impaired. We have to accept that. Our vision of the world, of the cosmos, is impaired by our conditioning, by being conditioned by the three modes of material nature. We can't see things clearly, and therefore we don't react clearly, and we don't accept very obvious things when they're pointed out. That if you do this, you're going to get a bad reaction, like that. We don't accept it. A few weeks ago, I was invited to be on a panel. There's a pagan club at Long Beach City College, and they have once a year a meeting where they invite people from different religions or different spiritual traditions to come and speak to their club. And not just the club members, but everyone is invited. So it was a packed house, actually, very full room. I'd say at least 50 or 60, and they had to keep asking people to move in so more can come in. So I was representing Hinduism, and then there was an atheist, and there was a person representing Wicca, and there was a person who was a professor there and who was the sponsor of the club. He represented Native American viewpoint. So, to different degrees, they presented their cloudy viewpoint of what life is all about. The atheist, he was actually a graduate of Long Beach City College. Older gentleman, he said he was 67 years old. And he had been to Vietnam. So his punchline was, yes, there actually are atheists in foxholes. Because there's a saying in English that there are no atheists in foxholes. In other words, when there's a war going on, everybody believes in God and they're praying to God that they will go home safely. But he said, I am living proof that there are atheists in foxholes. Because I don't believe in any God and I don't believe in, you know, his whole presentation was, I don't believe and I believe. I don't believe in any God. I don't believe in any deity that you have to worship. I believe you simply have to follow your human potential and, you know, live life to the fullest and this and that. And pretty much they're all on that same platform. whether they say they believe in some, like the Native American representative who was a professor at the school, he said the Native American viewpoint is that there may not be any ultimate deity, but we worship Mother Earth. The Earth is everything for us because the Earth provides everything that we need, and it goes on and on and on. And ultimately, you have to, you know, respect the Earth and live a life in such a way that you're happy, because who knows what's after this life, you know. And then the person who represented Wicca, same thing. You need a living guide to connect you to the spirit guides so that you can make the most of your life and get what you want out of life and enjoy life. So that was the whole presentation. So I pointed out to the students, and indirectly to Mr. Atheist, that believing or not believing doesn't make a thing exist or not exist. It's either God exists or doesn't exist. And your believing or not believing doesn't change that fact. So that's the first thing you have to understand. We're so puffed up that we think that if we believe something, or if I can get other people to see my viewpoint also and not believe or believe, then that makes the thing exist or not exist. No, it has nothing to do with it. And a simple example I use is if somebody had fallen into a coma 100 years ago, and they wake up now and you tell them that the president of the United States was black, and they say, oh, I don't believe it. It's impossible. It would never happen. They would never vote a black person, you know. Believing or not believing doesn't change the fact. It's either we have a black president or we don't. And your believing or not believing doesn't change that fact. So it's the same thing with God. Either God exists or God doesn't exist. And your believing or accepting or not believing or not accepting does not change that fact. So it's the same thing with a lot of things that we're reading in the Bhagavatam. Somebody may read the Bhagavatam, I don't believe that there's Mrita Sanjeevani, that somebody can bring somebody back from the dead. I don't believe that. Your believing or not believing doesn't change the fact. It's either that capacity, that ability is there, or it's not. Believing or your acceptance or not acceptance has nothing to do with it. So when we realize that, then we can start to see clearly what the Bhagavatam is presenting. And the method that the atheists and or atheistic scientists use, because, you know, the very first point I always establish is that you can't have an intimate regression of cause and effect. Everyone knows that. In other words, you have parents, they had parents, they had parents. You can't just have that going back ad infinitum. There has to be an original parent somewhere, a cause of all causes, a source of everything. Everyone agrees on that. So then the discussion comes to what is the nature of that source. Is it a personal source? In other words, a supreme being, a supreme person, or is it just a chunk of matter that explodes eventually and everything comes out of that explosion? Now we're just discussing the nature of the source, but you have to admit that it has to be ultimately a source of everything. So what the scientists do, atheistic scientists, because some scientists will say they believe in God, they make fun of anything that they can't accept, that they're clouded vision does not allow them to accept. Sariputta Prabhu made that point in one presentation he was making. He said that atheistic scientists believe that a horse laugh is worth 1,000 syllogisms. A syllogism is a logical step in an argument. I'm making an argument and I make one logical point and I make a logical point and it all adds up to something grander. What the atheistic scientists do is that they just make fun of you for believing in God. And that just ends the whole argument right there. That ends. So if they would read something like this, that King Ayati exchanged his old age and invalidity for the youth of his son. Ha ha ha. Can you believe that kind of stuff? Somebody can exchange their old age for youth. Ha ha ha. And they just wipe you out with that one laugh. Everybody laughs and then you're nothing. You're forgotten. Let's move on to facts. But again, if you examine their presentation, it's made up of ever-changing so-called facts. So-called facts. The classical one I like to use is that in my youth, we were taught that in the deepest... Can we turn off all the phones, please, so we don't get any disturbance? Thank you. In the deepest parts of the ocean, there are some very deep trenches in the ocean. You could put the Himalayas in several times. They're so deep. They taught us that in such places, because of the absence of sunlight and because of the pressure and the temperature, no life can exist. That was this scientific viewpoint many decades ago. And if you said, no, I don't believe you, they would laugh you out of the room. Because it's obvious. There's no sunlight. The pressure's too great. The temperature's, it's inhospitable. You can't have any life there. But later on, lo and behold, when they were able to send submersible craft down that deep, they saw that there is life down there. So they had to change their facts that they were presenting. The Bhagavatam is not like that. The Bhagavatam presentation is knowledge coming down from higher sources, and we have to accept. You may reject if you want, but there's no way you can disprove. There's no scientific experiment you can run to disprove the statement that King Ayati exchanged his old age and invalidity for the youth of his son. You can't prove that it can't be done. You may not believe it. You may get people to laugh at it as a proposition, but you cannot disprove it scientifically. There's a possibility that it could be true. Similarly, you cannot prove that mrtya sanjeevani does not exist, that ability to bring somebody from the dead, as long as the body is intact. You cannot prove scientifically that it can't be done. As a matter of fact, you're trying to do it scientifically every day. Somebody's rushed into some ER somewhere, they're apparently gone, and you're trying by some scientific means to bring them back to life with the electric shock and the this and the that. So you're trying to make this mrtya sanjeevani a fact. But when you read it in the Bhagavatam, no, I don't believe it. I don't accept it. It's not possible. So the point I'm trying to make is that we have to admit, most if not all of us in this room, have been conditioned to the point where we still have some doubt based on the fact that the science community doesn't accept this or that about this Bhagavatam presentation. And we have to get to the point where we totally kick that out. Because there's only two possibilities. Either you accept the Vedic viewpoint, the Vedic cosmological presentation, or you don't. There's no in-between. It's not that I can accept some of what the Vedas say and then reject some of it. That is not allowed. You have to accept the entire presentation as it is. So it's a challenge for us. It's a challenge. That means, ultimately, we have to accept Ishvara Parama Krishna Satchit Ananda Vigraha Anadir Adir Govinda Sarva Karna Karnam. That's the whole Vedic presentation in a nutshell. There may be many controllers, as Prabhupada would say. You may be controlling your family, you may be controlling your business, you may be controlling a city as mayor, or a state as governor, or as a whole country as president, or the whole universe as Lord Brahma. But ultimately there is a Parameshwara, a supreme controller who is controlling everyone and whom nobody controls. So that is Krishna. Ishvara Parama Krishna. He is the supreme controller. Satchid Ananda Vigraha. He has form. It's not formless. We all have form, and we see the combination of forms produces more forms. Whether it's male and female dog get together to produce a dog form, and the male and female cats get together to produce a cat form. The trees germinate the seeds and another tree comes up. There's always form where there's life, isn't it? Does anybody know of any formless life anywhere? Where there's life, there's form. So the supreme living entity has form. It's just a natural conclusion. But what is the nature of that form? His form is not like the forms that we have, that we see anyway, because ultimately our form is actually like his form. But we don't see that when we look at each other. We see Asian bodies and American bodies, Russian, Chinese, whatever. We don't see the actual person, so we're not seeing the actual form of the person. But form is there anyway. Wherever we see life, whether it's plant life or beast life or bird life or aquatic life or human life, there is form. So as we said, we can't have an infinite regression of cause and effect. So the ultimate cause of everything has to have form. We have form, and everywhere we see form, so the source of everything has to have form. And the nature of that form is given by Lord Brahma. Sat Chit Ananda Vigraha. Sat, eternality, Chit, supreme consciousness, which is the elephant in the room for the atheists, and I pointed it out to the students, that they're saying that everything comes from combination of matter, but at what point does matter become conscious? They claim they're making a scientific presentation, but they have never, ever proven that. As a matter of fact, most of them completely avoid that subject. They'll talk till the cows come home about zoology and biology and physics and this and that, but they'll never touch on consciousness. Because they can't figure it out. They cannot prove. In order to be scientific, they would have to be able to prove that we can combine these material elements and make a conscious entity. And we see there are conscious entities everywhere. Some of them so minute you can barely see them. Some of them minute you can't see them. But there's consciousness there. The very smallest insect that you can find, they're conscious. You try to stop them from doing something and they'll get around you. They are conscious. Just like we're conscious. And somebody tries to impede us, we find a way to go around it. So the smallest insect, there's consciousness there. You cannot avoid consciousness. But they won't touch it because they cannot prove scientifically how consciousness arises from matter. So we nail them on that point. And as Prabhupada used to say, when there was some opposition to the Krishna consciousness movement and quite often culminating in court cases, Prabhupada said, go and tell them that before they can make any conclusion, they have to read all of my books. If they don't read my books, how do they know what it is I'm presenting? How can they oppose it if they don't know what it is? How can you say the Krishna consciousness movement is bad for people if you don't know what the Krishna consciousness movement is presenting to the people? So tell them, tell the judge, tell the lawyers, the opposing lawyers, they have to read my books before they can make any judgment. It's a logical request. On the other side of the coin, before we can properly defend the Krishna consciousness movement, we have to know what's in Prabhupada's books. We have to see what it is that people can possibly object to, and we have to have the arguments to counter it. But ultimately, at the end of the day, we have to accept and understand that we may not be able to prove anything ourselves by argument. We can explain to people why we accept the Vedic viewpoint, but we can't necessarily prove by argument. I pointed out to the students again that there's a lot of empiric evidence for the existence of something beyond the body that survives the death experience, namely what we would say the soul or spirit, whatever you want to call it. There's a lot of empiric evidence, and Mr. Atheist immediately, I don't believe in that. His whole thing was, I don't believe. Again, like his believing or not believing makes something exist or not exist. Very foolish for an educated person. And the students picked up on that right away. Yeah, I mean, believing or not believing doesn't make the thing true or not true. So we can understand when we go into these universities, colleges, why the predecessor acharyas have labeled material education as a slaughterhouse. Because here they are. They're in the prime of their desire to know. They really want to know. And forget that it's a pagan club. It's just an excuse for coming together to discuss. And I commended them for that. That you've come together and invited outsiders to come and speak to you on these very important topics of spirituality and origins. It's extremely commendable. But leave yourselves open to really understanding. Don't just be shunted into this kind of, I believe, I don't believe, and, you know, life is just about enjoying. No, there's a lot more to that. We all experience. We all have desire. That's why we're here discussing these kind of things. So it's unfortunate that in many schools, if not all of the schools, they have no capacity to give them real knowledge, that the real knowledge that they're looking for. They're yearning for real understanding. And we have the answers if we accept them ourselves. If we don't really accept them, if we have our own doubts about what's stated in Srila Prabhupada's books, which is a presentation, a distilled presentation of all Vedic knowledge. The Bhagavad Gita is known as Gita Upanishad. It is considered to be the essence of all Vedic knowledge. And Prabhupada has given us that essence and more so that we can have firm faith in a Vedic cosmological viewpoint, in the existence of a supreme deity, namely Krishna, Satchidananda Vigraha, eternity, bliss, knowledge, Anadir Adir, he has no origin, he's the origin of everything, Anadir Adir Govinda, Sarva Karana Karanam, he is the cause of all causes. Just that one verse, if we can really enter into that one verse, the beginning of Lord Brahma's presentation, in the fifth chapter of his Brahma Samhita, if we can just latch on to that one verse and understand that, then everything else becomes understandable. Because if you don't accept that there's a supreme deity, the supreme controller. If you don't accept that eternality is there, things exist eternally, namely ourselves, the supreme self, Krishna, and his energies are all eternal, then the whole presentation doesn't make any sense. So we have to really understand that verse. We have to understand and accept everything as it's presented in the Vedic theology, the Vedic cosmology. And then we can very sincerely and effectively present it to others. So Yayati, we can say he didn't actually regain his youth. He stole the youth of his son, requested the youth of his son, who gave it to him. And after enjoying for 1,000 years, he was still not satisfied. So ultimately, turned to devotional service, turned to bhakti yoga. So the point to us is, don't waste time chasing after material happiness. It's ephemeral. Whatever amount of happiness you're due, you're going to get. And whatever amount of distress you're due, you're going to get. And this world is becoming increasingly dangerous because people don't accept these very simple points. Even when they turn to, and this came up, Mr. Atheist brought this up also, that these so-called religious people, they're actually the cause of a lot of the problems in the world. So I made the same point that I made online, I think I mentioned in my last class, that a lot of crimes are committed by atheists. Should we outlaw atheism? Why do you want to outlaw theism? Nobody, you don't see anybody running around with banners, outlaw atheism. No, they'll always rail against God and religion because they think it's the cause of so many problems. No, the cause of the problem is people who pose themselves as religionists, as being religious. Just like there's so many people who pose themselves as being doctors. Recently on the internet there was a case, there was a guy on a cruise ship. This is a true story. He was not a doctor, he was a fake, but he posed himself as a doctor, and he was on that cruise ship treating people medically for years. They just finally busted him. Imagine, he's not a real doctor. He faked his credentials, and he was actually treating people on this cruise ship for years. Who knows what the heck he was doing? Probably causing more harm than good. So in the same way, there are many people who pose themselves as being religious, but they're not. They don't know the first thing about religion. If you really press them. And they're the ones that cause the trouble. Those who are actually religious, who actually know God and want to serve God and love God, they're not causing any problems. But unfortunately, they become targets of these pseudo-religionists. Right now, I don't know if you've read that in Bangladesh, the so-called Muslims have been attacking the devotees. They go to devotee programs and they actually threw a bomb and fortunately it didn't go off. And then when people were running out, they were shooting at them. They shot a couple of people. Unfortunately, nobody died, but some people were attending that Namahata. It was a Namahata program. So they've already started. And we should be ready here in America. Don't think it's not coming to our doorstep. You know, obviously, these jihadis and so-called, they've cranked it up to another level where now, instead of trying to fight armed camps, they're going after soft targets, like they did in San Bernardino. They're going after soft targets, and we're probably the softest target out there. We're so open. From 4:30 in the morning till 8:30 at night, anybody can come in this place, go anywhere on the property. We are an extremely soft target. So we should be prepared. Prabhupada said back in the 70s, in this very room, or in this very compound, I don't remember if it was in the temple room, but he said that we don't take seriously protection of the community, protection of the deities. We have to take it seriously. He said, preparation means, in this day and age, guns and sticks. Now, it doesn't mean that everybody should run out and buy a gun. Back in the 70s, a lot of devotees did run out and buy guns. L.A. was an armed camp, L.A. ISKCON, at one point, extremely armed. But devotees were responsible. There was not one case, I remember, of any devotee misusing, their ability to carry weapons. As a matter of fact, they used their knowledge very nicely. They used to attack the San Diego temple regularly and beat up the devotees. And they called the LA devotees to come down and help them. And they went down and beat the... It was the Hell's Angels guys that were attacking. And they went down and beat them so badly that they stopped. So We have to be prepared. Don't be surprised if they're already targeting us in other countries. Don't be surprised if they come here. Because it's Kali Yuga, and irreligion is taken as religion, and real religion is seen as irreligion, and it's just completely topsy-turvy. So we have to really, really accept what Prabhupada is presenting, accept it, follow it, and then we can boldly present it to others in the form of Prabhupada's books. Because people are looking for answers, just like those students. And unfortunately, they're being misled by the administration of the schools that they go to, by the people that they invite to speak to them, like this atheist and this Wicca representative and, you know, people like that. They come in and they have good intentions because they believe that what they're presenting is true. But it's not true from our perspective. We know it's absolutely not true. And they're simply misleading people. Innocuously sometimes and dangerously most of the time. They're misleading people. Because the choices that they make in life are going to determine what is going to come down the pike to them later on. You know, whatever action they perform is going to produce some reaction, good or bad, that they have to enjoy or suffer in the future. So it is our duty to go out there and present Bhagavad Gita as it is, Srimad Bhagavatam as it is, so that people can get the real truth, real knowledge by which they can live their lives successfully, and at the end of life go back to home, back to Godhead. So we can stop here. Any questions? Bhakti and Andrea's hand shot up immediately. Microphone, please.
Thank you for such a nice class, Prabhu. I was just wondering, you were saying, you know, Prabhupada said that we should be more, you know, defensive and more. So I understand that, but couldn't someone make the argument of, you know, Rakhe Krishna Madhike, Madhe Krishna Rakhe?
Yes, excellent question. She's saying that, can't you make the argument that Krishna protects, and if Krishna protects you, nobody can harm you, and if Krishna wants to harm somebody, they can't protect themselves? Yes, but part of the way that Krishna protects you is by giving you intelligence. There's this story, it's a Christian story, but it applies to us also, that there was an area that was being flooded. So when the flood came, started to come, they came in an SUV and to this one house and said, you know, come, we'll take you out of here. No, no, God will protect me. So then the waters rose up higher and then a boat came. Come, we'll take you out of here. No, no, God will protect me. And then the waters went to high, the guy had to go on the roof and a helicopter came. Come, we'll bring you. No, no, God will protect me. So finally he drowned. So then he came before God and he said, Why didn't you protect me? God said, I sent a SUV, a boat, helicopter. What do you want? So Krishna gives the intelligence by which you can protect yourself. Just like the Battle of Kurukshetra. He didn't come out with his divine weapons and just wipe out the other side. He was constantly telling Arjuna and the Pandavas what to do, what not to do, how to go forward, how to win, how to giving intelligence. So Krishna gives us intelligence how to protect ourselves. If we don't use our intelligence to lock the doors and to have guards and to have, then how can we blame Krishna? Krishna's giving you the intelligence. Use it to protect yourself. Rabindranath Prabhu.
Yes, it's mentioned how Yati had no material desire. I think it was when he was worshiping Narayana. And then later on, the next verse mentions how he was frustrated with his material desires or sense gratification. So how do you understand both things?
I think you asked that question before, and it was nicely answered by Shastrakrit, that it was a gradual thing. It wasn't that overnight he
gave up his material desires. Yeah, but it does say... It does say he was without material desires.
Yeah, at the end. After trying for 1,000 years to enjoy, after he regained his youth and tried like anything, and he did, they went all over. You know, sometimes we read these descriptions and we're thinking, God, I would love to join that Krishna consciousness movement where you get to travel all over the universe and enjoy sense gratification. But, so he did. He gave it his best shot. But we know, because we are spiritual beings, in the material world, we're like fish out of water. So it doesn't matter what you get. You could get a spaceship like Cardinal Muni made for Devahuti and travel all over the universe, and you still will not be satisfied because we're still in the material world. We're It's a foreign element. So it doesn't matter what we have materially, we can never be satisfied. So this is proven in this case of Yayati. He got his youth back, and he went for it. And he enjoyed like anything materially, or tried his best. But then at the end, he had to admit that he was still not happy. And therefore, his natural devotional sentiment became stronger and stronger to the point where he came back to the platform of pure being a pure devotee. So that's for him.
Thank you for your class. Your class reminded me of something that I read not too long ago, where Prabhupada said that unless people understand or feel the presence of the Supreme Lord in every living entity and doesn't understand that Krishna is there, Prabhupada said that this is what's called, you know, in a mode of ignorance, a worshiping in the mode of ignorance. And you were bringing up about some religious faiths that are practicing and doing crazy things. So Prabhupada said that's the first principle of spiritual life, that we have to understand that there's a super soul in each and every living entity, and that is the only way we can stop violence. Otherwise, everything is in a mode of ignorance. And Prabhupada said, just like you have a fire sacrifice, you have all the paraphernalia there, everything's there, and you have the ghee. But if you're pouring the ghee on ashes, what is the benefit of your sacrifice, your austerity? So in human society, they're doing this. They're doing so many sacrifices, so many, like some people are sacrificing their body, put a bomb on it and blow everybody up because they have no understanding of the presence of the Lord. Even in their own body, they don't understand. So Prabhupada said, if there's going to be any spiritual or material advancement, unless they come to the point of understanding that Krishna is in each and every living entity, everything is in a mode of ignorance. And when you think of that word ignorance, you know, if you see some person and you say, man, that person is really ignorant, it's like so apparent. So you can see our whole society around the world, everywhere, it's in a mode of ignorance. And that's why it's so important for us to espouse this philosophy. That is the difference between Krishna consciousness and anything else that you see in the world in terms of material advancement, spiritual advancement. It's all ignorant.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that because this teacher, professor at a school who was into Native America, he's not even an Indian. He's not even Native American himself. He's Caucasian. But he said, you know, when he was in the army, he met a lot of Native Americans and he became really attracted to their mode of life. And one of the things that they do is this austerity and the mode of ignorance. He said to appease Mother Earth, they put hooks into their skin and hang themselves from trees. Cause that pain to the body as a way of trying to appease Mother Earth. I don't think Mother Bhumi wants us to do that. According to the Bhagavatam, she just wants us to be devotees of Krishna. And she's very happy if we do that. Just become a devotee of Krishna, Mother Earth will be extremely satisfied. You don't have to do all these intense, you know, painful austerities. It's not necessary. Jai. Okay, thank you. Granta Rachman Bhagavatam Ki Jai. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai.
Thank you.